It's May 7th, 2014, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa, and we cover the Geek Beat here on Hawaii Public Radio.
And first, we'll look at the latest tech news and happenings in Hawaii and beyond. And joining us today is Dave Rippey, and he's from Island Funder, and he's here to tell us about the upcoming workshops on crowdfunding. Also, Brian Butling, tell us about the first Startup Week in Maui.
Finally, we hope you'll join us as we explore the cosmos and perhaps answer all of your burning questions about the mysteries of the universe with astronomers Alex Filipenko and Roy Gal. So we welcome your questions and thoughts as part of that conversation. Be ready to call in or tweet. But first, the headlines.
While unmanned aerial vehicles or drones are becoming an increasingly common sight in skies over Hawaii, for now they're operating strictly as a hobby and not in commercial or official capacities. But on Monday, the Federal Aviation Administration officially opened drone testing sites that will become or include the Aloha State. The FAA had recently approved a 2-year Certificate of Authorization or COA to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, which had submitted a proposal covering drone testing in Alaska, Oregon, and Hawaii. The three locations comprise Pan Pacific UAS Test Range Complex.
At the FAA ceremony held at the university and streamed live on the web, a 2.5-pound Arion Scout quadcopter was launched from the school's large animal research station. On the UAF campus, researchers will evaluate the use of drones in conducting animal population surveys. In Hawaii, the testing will incorporate high-altitude drone flights over the ocean. And across the complex, the testing will examine how drone use can be integrated into the nation's airspace and its regulation. The FAA is hoping to welcome drones into American airspace by 2015, and that's in response to a congressional mandate to do so made in 2012.
Well, despite the focus on expanding drone use, there are increasing calls to restrict them. Hawaii legislators had considered but dropped a bill that would have limited drone use to law enforcement. And in just last week, Yosemite National Park in California and Zion National Park in Utah had banned their use within the park boundaries. And I understand that that is now applicable to all national parks.
One interpretation of those two national parks forbidding their use, they're using existing regulations that apply to all parks. And so some people are interpreting it saying that, yes, it would include the Volcanoes National Park or other national parks. Mm-hmm. The regulation does talk about using any kind of aerial vehicle to deliver or pick up things. And so presumably the drone enthusiasts will argue that on a technicality that they don't apply. But the fact of the matter is you can see that as they become more popular, there's going to be more resistance to it if they're not operated responsibly. I was just reading an article in the West Hawaii Today on the Big Island where someone who was out camping got buzzed by a drone who flew over his picnic site,
mm-hmm.
and then flew away. And he has no idea who it was, what they were doing, if they were taking pictures. And he was so mad. He's like, I'm going to see if what we can do to ban this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So It's fascinating that they're trying to expand use. The FAA wants to incorporate them. But if the people who currently are using them as hobbies aren't careful and responsible,
mm-hmm.
they could get a backlash for sure.
Right. And of course, we've covered this story when they announced the six sites that were going to be these test sites by the FAA. But this one kind of made the news because this was actually the first official flight in Alaska
mm-hmm.
for this consortium, which includes Hawaii. And when Hawaii does fly its first one for testing and sort of the privacy that they're exploring, we'll definitely report on that.
But, the accessibility is so exciting. My coworker just ordered his.
I think one of our guests just ordered his.
We might talk about that. I just got the domain hawaiidrones.com,
and I'm going to start putting
some stuff there. But again, I am worried about the enthusiasm and how accessible it is and how you will have to be careful about
it for sure.
Well, Hawaiian words have a long history of being adopted by technology companies looking for a unique name. From Akamai Technologies to the venerated Wiki, some are nearly household names. But when an app to promote awareness of sexually transmitted diseases called itself Hula, the reaction was swift and harsh. The Los Angeles-based developer announced this week, though, that it would change its name in response to complaints that it was culturally insensitive to Native Hawaiians, and they reversed course from a couple of months ago when even an online petition failed to prompt a change.
Well, the Hula app was launched earlier this year, described as Yelp for STD testing centers. It provided information on different diseases, helped users track testing appointments and results, and even offered tips to broach the sensitive topic with partners. Native Hawaiian community leaders and members protested. In addition to the petition, which ultimately drew over 4,000 supporters, newspaper op-eds and blogs criticized the use of the word hula and used the phrase getting laid. While the reference to lay was removed, company founder Ramin Bastiani said in March that it would keep the name.
But last week, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and members of the Hawaiian Affairs Caucus in the state Senate issued an official statement calling the name, quote, highly insensitive. Now, Bastiani said in a statement, as we continue to listen and learn, we realize that this is the right thing for us to do. He did add that it will take some time to make the change across its app, website, and marketing. OHA CEO Kamano Opono told the Associated Press yesterday, we appreciate this change in acknowledgement that no culture should be demeaned for profit or convenience.
You know, and I think that's a good statement in terms of, you know, taking advantage of especially the Hawaiian language for profit and convenience. You know, every time I hear about a company, and there's a lot of them that are starting up on the, you know, start up on the mainland, like Mahalo.com and Akamai, right, like you mentioned. And I was at the Code for America Summit last year, and one of the groups there developed something called the Ohana API, which was for a good cause, which was social services API. But, you know, it kind of, you have this sort of sense of place when they use the word, and are they sensitive to the place that it comes from?
Right, and it's interesting that at this around the same time that this hula app came out, that was when there was the announcement by Neil Young that he wants to do a new MP3, an audio player, a high audio fidelity audio player, and he's calling it the Pono. And he is definitely trying to invoke the Hawaiian meaning of that word as well. But presumably a high-tech, music-forward sort of device for people who are interested in the fidelity of their music is not quite as controversial as a sexually transmitted disease app.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, I agree. I mean, you try to find a good name for your company, and if you can't find a good English word, you're going to try other languages. Mm-hmm. But there is certainly a lot of history, and especially when you talk about appropriation to, you know, American companies versus the Hawaiian language.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a couple of events that we wanted to share with you. First, a reminder for an event we talked about last week when we featured Big Island Tech. This Saturday brings the Hawaii Island Demo Day and New Business Showcase, kicking off at 1 p.m. at the Imiloa Astronomy Center. The Demo Day will highlight some of the Big Island's newest and most innovative companies. And for more information, you can go to hitx.co/demo day.
And next Wednesday after our show, Tyler Crowley will be the featured speaker at the Founders Lectures event taking place at Iolani School's Sullivan Center. Crowley is executive producer of the Launch Conference, as well as This Week in Startups, and he'll speak about building a great company and then provide feedback to business pitches from the audience. Again, that's Wednesday, May 14th at 6:30 p.m., and to register, you can go to fi.co.
fi.co.
FoundersInstitute.co. Yeah.
Well, joining us here in the studio is Dave Rippey, and he's here from Island Funder to tell us about the crowdfunding workshop they're putting together. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, so tell us about a little bit about, you know, what you want to cover in this crowdfunding. I mean, you know, a lot of people come up and ask us about the sort of the intricacies of crowdfunding. We actually had a show featuring a couple of folks that did, you know, like a really pretty successful Kickstarter campaigns. But tell us a little bit about your crowdfunding workshop.
Yeah, our workshop's a little bit different because basically because of the time that we're running it. There's been a ton of studies come out recently that universities have been doing and from last year's statistics of crowdfunding that are really changing the game because we have so much information on what helps you create a successful crowdfunding campaign, what practices have really worked in the past, mm-hmm. that information that wasn't there, you know, last year. So we're taking everything that we've learned and we're putting it into these workshops to walk people through each step of creating a campaign and what we were able to find, the little things, do's and don'ts, even in just naming your campaign to the amount of words used in your description. And we take everything that we've learned and we're putting it into this two-day workshop to try to teach people as much as we can. Mm-hmm. There is a ton about it. There's a ton of information. There's a million things you can do. But we're trying to work hands-on and be there for people and really push crowdfunding here locally and help local businesses, entrepreneurs, and start, you know, nonprofits get the information they need to be successful on mm-hmm. this platform.
Now tell us a little bit about Island Funder, which is your platform. I think it was not quite a year ago, but I had blogged about it when it was launching. And I think the shorthand is it's a Kickstarter but specifically focused on Hawaii. Is that essentially it? And what have you been up to since?
Yeah, thanks. It's similar to that. It is a crowdfunding platform like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, mm-hmm. but there's a lot more open opportunities on our platform. One, we offer different types of funding, flexible and fixed funding. Kickstarter only offers fixed funding. You have to reach your goal or you get nothing. Mm-hmm. We're able to offer that flexible funding where even if you don't reach your goal, but you can still use the money that you raised to push your business or start your project, then that's an available option. We also allow nonprofits, like I said earlier, to raise money on, and Kickstarter doesn't have that option for nonprofits. We do have team support on creating the campaigns, and that's the biggest part, I believe, the difference is. If you go to Kickstarter, they have a lot of information. I love Kickstarter. I mean, they have a lot of good stuff going on there. But it doesn't work well for certain local businesses or local small companies, or if someone has a food truck that they want to push and they're only able to really offer their food as an incentive. On Island Funder, there's a lot more opportunity to do something like that than on Kickstarter, where you have to mail your contributions, mm-hmm. contributors across all the world. So we try to put a local touch on it. We try to create relationships with the people who are starting these businesses with the local community. And we, as a business, team with those people to help them run a successful campaign. And we are throwing these type of workshops, and we're meeting with these people one-on-one. So even though Kickstarter has this huge following and they have a lot of successful things on Kickstarter, you can be unsuccessful on Kickstarter if you don't do it right.
And so are the projects that go on Island Funder, are they of the same sort of magnitude as a Kickstarter project, or maybe a little bit more smaller but more geared toward the local market?
Yeah, so right now they're definitely smaller mm-hmm. Campaigns that are geared towards the local market, and their clients or their future business revolves around Hawaii. And we want to push it and get to the point to where people are able to reach out. And, anyone can contribute to a campaign on Island Funder from mm-hmm. all over the world. And we do try to promote that. But it's mainly focused on the Hawaiian culture, the local businesses here. And we want to grow it. We want it to get to that point to where you can have these huge goal amounts to create a business. But if you want to do that, you got to get the community behind you.
Mm-hmm. Now, for your workshops, are there any specific case studies that you're looking forward to highlight?
Yes, we have a ton of case studies. And it's not just case studies on crowdfunding. We also have case studies when it comes to the more important things about running a successful crowdfunding campaign is your daily marketing plans. So we have a lot of studies on email marketing, and we're going to go over what's the best time of day and best day of the week to send mm-hmm. out an email about your crowdfunding campaign. We have a ton of studies and statistics from over 12,000 crowdfunding campaigns of last year, the statistics on what they did to raise the most money based on percentage of money raised. Mm-hmm. And we're coming across new things all the time. I mean, there's a lot of universities are pushing out these new research studies that they've been doing. And so if you combine all these things together, you have a successful chance to raise money on any platform. And that doesn't matter if it's Island Funder, Kickstarter, or anything. I mean, there's companies today that are creating their own platforms on their websites and raising millions of dollars just on their websites. Mm-hmm. So it really comes down to preparation, understanding a daily marketing plan. And, if you're trying to raise $10,000, it's not just easy. You don't just put something up and go, okay, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and there's going to be $10,000 in there.
So where can people find out more about the workshop and sign up for it and take advantage of what you
can do? Yeah, you can find out about the workshop on islandfunder.com, and that's mm-hmm. Funder with an F. I know sometimes I think I say thunder, but it's islandfunder.com.
Good point.
And if you go to the blog, it has a link right there. It talks about the workshops, and you can contact us and sign up.
And that's coming up when?
The first day, the first workshop is May 10th, so this Saturday at 1 p.m. And then day two is a week later, same Saturday at 2 p.m. And we actually teamed up with Box Jelly. So if you do come to the crowdfunding day one, you're going to get a free week of crowdfunding space at Box Jelly where you can work on your campaign during that week. And join us on day two as well.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Dave. And we also want to welcome Brian Buettling to the show, and he can talk about the first ever Startup Weekend Maui.
Woohoo! Thank you for having me, guys. I'm really excited about this.
Well, you know, Brian, we cover Startup Weekends quite a bit. There's a number of series that have happened here on Oahu, both the ones that happen, say, at the Box Jelly, as well as one at UH mm-hmm. For their entrepreneurial program. But, you know, it's always good, just like TED and other of these franchised events, to incorporate and reach the neighbor islands as well.
Yeah.
So this is, I believe, the first Startup Weekend happening on Maui. And first of all, what led up to it finally happening?
So I'm originally from Maui, and I am obviously a huge supporter of startups building an ecosystem here on Oahu. And when I thought about the opportunity of putting it to Maui first, I thought, well, is there any ecosystem out there? Are there people out there? And then when I met Arben of Embloom, I immediately knew there's opportunity there. And then you just sort of get intertwined with the community there. And there's a lot of people who want to see the ecosystem, the tech startup scene build on Maui. It's just, it's all divided up. And so the purpose with Startup Weekend is to bring everyone to this one space where they all can meet each other, network, and then hopefully build companies after that.
Is there a primary contact that you're working through? Is it Arben?
Yeah. So I'm working with the team over at Embloom and Bump Networks. Mm-hmm. So they're the organizing team.
Mm-hmm. So they're on their feet on the ground and kind of
yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So their feet on the ground. I'm kind of working with them in regards to a facilitator status. So I'm kind of guiding them throughout the planning of the weekend, and then I'll be over there next week running the event itself.
Now, one of the presenters I noticed was Google for Entrepreneurs. And is that going to be part of the program in terms of making available some of the platform that some of these startups could use?
We're trying to tie it in as much as possible. A lot of our sponsorships, and I know Google is one of the major national sponsors. And the reason why we're doing that is because we've seen a huge amount of developers on Maui. I was actually blown away about the number of developers we have signed up already. And this is huge. I mean, if you're looking to join a Startup Weekend, the best ones are usually the ones where there's a lot of developers because they're willing to work. And not only that, they're really excited about building a prototype because that's nothing more exciting than taking an idea and building a prototype in 54 hours.
You know, we love it when we have the Neighbor Island representation come on the show. Mm-hmm. Last week, we had a whole show kind of dedicated to Big Island tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So are there sort of plans perhaps to maybe expand to other islands?
I would love to. I just got back from Hilo a couple of weeks ago, and I just love what they're doing over there. Yeah. Eventually, I want to have one over there.
What was it? What would it take? I mean, I know Embloom contacted you. Yeah, does it just take somebody from
It just takes someone on
maybe
the
Hawaii TechWorks folks, maybe give you a call and say, hey, you know, we want to do something out here?
Yeah, definitely. If anyone from Hilo is listening.
Yeah, they're listening. Yeah. I know they are.
You can reach at me at Startup Week or at SWHNL on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Or just
we'll put it out on a show.
Yeah.
Note, so yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so this is an event that anybody can come, pitch an idea, hopefully build a team.
Yeah.
And some people are going to come with a team and an idea, and some are just want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Is there a theme that you think might emerge, or that you're already picking up from some of the interests that you're getting? Is it alternative energy? Is it games? Anything strike you?
Not really. What I'm really looking for, what I'm hoping for too, especially with Maui, is something to tie into farming. Introducing tech and farming because I was out there recently and the farming movement out there is huge right now, especially with ecotourism. And introducing some sort of tech with that would be huge for Maui. Yeah. Just because it's such a beautiful place.
Are you talking about sort of the boutique kind of like lavender farms and Protea and stuff like that? Or are you talking about like aquaponics and, you know, or growing sort of in unique technical frames, you know, for let's say soilless growth?
Well, for me, it's more of just combining tech into the normal workday of a farmer, and saying, oh, how can I apply an app? You know, how can an app make my life as a farmer more efficient? You know, is there software out there that's not really there yet, but it could be? And if Maui could be leading the way there globally, I think that'd be perfect for it.
Well, keep us posted on some of the teams. And certainly when the winners are announced, we're going to see what we can do to feature them. But if somebody wanted to participate in Startup Weekend on Maui, the first ever, where can they go for more information?
They can go to maui.startupweekend.org. They can find us on social media at SWHNL. They can follow me, Brada Boots on Twitter.
Brada Boots.
And yeah, it's going to be an awesome show. Sarah Smith, who won a Startup Week in Honolulu, is going to be there mentoring. We got a lot of great judges coming down, and there is a special prize, but we're not going to announce it until next week.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks, Dave and Brian, for joining us.
Much appreciated, guys. Thank you.
And thank you. Oh.
And that's what's been happening this week. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be joined by Alex Filipenko and Roy Gal from the Institute for Astronomy.
We can explore the nature of our universe, and of course, this is a great opportunity to tap one of the more brilliant and fun minds out there in astrophysics. So please give us a call at 941-3689 or toll-free from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689.
And of course, we're live, so you can tweet your questions too at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Back in April, Eric and Charlotte Kaufman were sailing to New Zealand with their 3-year-old and their 1-year-old, and they made international news when they got into trouble in the open seas. This week on This American Life, they give their first interview about what happened. Cracks in their hull and water leaking in and their satellite phone failing. They had 2 radios but couldn't tell if they were working or not. Their baby's sick, and they have to decide whether to abandon ship. Literally abandon ship. That's this week.
Saturday at 1 p.m.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Terry Tempest Williams, author of Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about mosaics, about finding beauty in a broken world.
Sunday morning at 11.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today is Alex Filipenko and Roy Gal. Alex is a professor of astronomy over at UC Berkeley. We won't hold that against him. And specializes in supernova active galaxies, black holes, gamma ray bursts, and the expansion, accelerating expansion of the universe.
Roy, meanwhile, is an assistant astronomer who does research in galaxy evolution as well as oversees and coordinates the Institute for Astronomy at UH and its outreach activities and media relations.
And how does one determine if the universe is actually expanding or contracting? And I know these are the questions that are burning in your mind, so we'd love to hear your questions and comments. And of course, that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. Alex and Roy, I want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
So, Roy, you know, you have been our key contact to the whole, you know, astronomic society, the whole community out there.
And the galaxy, the universe. Yes.
You know, you are the one that have inspired us to perhaps change our name to Exoplanet Palooza. But you introduced Alex. Tell us a little bit about Alex, because I think you can more justly, you know, give him the due respect that he deserves.
All right, so Alex, as you'll hear throughout the program, is an excellent communicator of everything astronomical. Mm-hmm. And he's a professor at UC Berkeley, as you said. He's won many awards as a best professor there. He won the Carl Sagan Award for Astronomy Popularization, so actually perfect with the second-generation Cosmos. Cosmos,
yes, yes.
TNG,
that's what it should have been called,
right now. So he's really good at conveying these complicated concepts in a simple and understandable way. So this talk series that we have, the Explorers of the Universe, we want to bring people who have great name recognition and who can communicate astronomy, because it's not enough to win a Nobel Prize. You might not be able to tell the public about it. So you want someone who can really does great work and can tell the world about it in a way that we can all understand it. So that's why he's here.
That's great. And we really welcome you, Alex, for joining us. And I'm just glad that we had the opportunity to, you know, make this show available. And
I'm always very happy to do this kind of thing. And I thank Roy for inviting me out in the first place, and the two of you, Bert and Ryan, for having me join you on this show.
And you had
it's a pleasure.
It sounds like you did space explanations on television long before that upstart Neil deGrasse Tyson got involved. So, you know.
Yeah, but he's got the big one now, Cosmos,
right,
you know, the remake.
That's true. So, well, as Roy knows, that you know, there are a lot of really, really complex concepts that come with astrophysics.
Right.
And so being able to convey that to people like us who are curious but perhaps not fully qualified in the sciences is very important.
I really enjoy doing it, because I find that people have an innate curiosity about these sorts of things, but in at times it needs to be cultivated. They don't even really know sometimes what questions to ask. So if I start talking about something interesting, then, you know, it excites them. They ask the kind of questions that have been bugging them inside, but that they couldn't articulate earlier.
So tell me about the young Alex. I mean, what was the question in your mind looking up into the sky that said, this is the path I'm going to choose?
Well, you know, when I was 14, I kind of discovered Saturn on my own with a little telescope that my parents had given me. I didn't know what was what in the sky, and it was the third bright star, quote unquote, that I pointed to, and it turned out to be Saturn. And that gave me this incredible thrill of discovery. And I figured, you know, if it's so much fun and so thrilling to discover something that millions of people have known about before you, how must it be to truly find something new in the universe, and then to be able to explain it to people and show how we're gaining a better and better understanding of our place in the universe and how the whole thing works.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned that you were on both teams that got the Nobel Prize in Physics on the sort of the accelerating, expanding universe.
That's right.
And of course, and you also mentioned that you wouldn't necessarily tell anybody unless they got you sufficiently
inebriated.
Drunk. But maybe we'll put you on the spot here and say, what was it that you were researching that sort of got you on both teams?
Yeah. What we were interested in was what the fate of the universe would be. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people know that it's expanding. That was a great discovery made by Edwin Hubble nearly a century ago. But all these galaxies are pulling on one another, just like, you know, an apple gets pulled on by the Earth and slows down when you throw it up. So, too, galaxies should be slowing down in their expansion away from one another because of the mutual gravitational attraction between all these galaxies. And so the question naturally was, will the universe slow down so much that someday it'll come to a stop and then, you know, sort of implode on itself, collapse, sort of a big crunch, if you will? Or will it expand forever? Because although the galaxies are pulling on one another and slowing down the expansion, they don't slow it to a halt, or at least not until time equals infinity. And that's kind of like an apple heaved at a speed at or greater than the escape speed from the Earth. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do that. You can do that with rockets and stuff. I mean, gravity is still pulling, but they can get away. So we wanted to explore the fate of the universe. And the way to do that is look back at the expansion history, see how much the universe has been slowing down, and from that, you can predict the future. Just like if you look at an apple and see that it's been slowing down a lot, you can predict that it'll someday stop and come back. And what we found was that, you know, in the past 4 or 5 billion years, instead of the expansion slowing down, it's actually been speeding up. So that's sort of like the wrong sign, right? We got the wrong answer. But it was the right answer. A lot of people were able to confirm this result through independent techniques. And that's always very important in science. And in fact, the more important the result, the more critical it is to have different methods that lead to the same result before you believe it to any real degree. And in the 11 years since 1998, you know, leading up to or in the 13 years leading up to 2011, which is when the Nobel Prize was awarded, enough other complementary studies had been done that verified that this acceleration, the speeding up, seems to actually be occurring. And we don't know yet why it's occurring, but it does seem to be occurring.
Was it because of the studies that you had been doing on supernova?
That's right. It's the supernova studies. And so a supernova is an exploding star, which is really interesting. We can talk about that later. But the elements, the heavy elements of which we are made, were cooked up by nuclear reactions deep inside stars long ago and then, you know, ejected into the cosmos by these explosions, thus becoming raw material for the formation of new stars, planets, and ultimately us. But for our purposes, we were using them as a beacon. They're very powerful. They're very luminous, okay? They're like a headlight that can be seen from a very, very great distance. So by looking at nearby ones and figuring out how powerful they really are, and then looking at distant ones and seeing how bright they appear to be, we could figure out how far away they are. And that tells us how far back in time we're looking, because something that's, in a sense, a billion light years away, you're seeing as it was a billion years ago. And so if you look at things that are 1, 5, 7, 10 billion light years away, you're looking back 1, 5, 7, 10 billion years ago, and you can trace the expansion history. That's the whole point. That's like looking at the apple at many stages of its motion. You can figure out how much the universe has been slowing down with time, but it hasn't been slowing down. In the past 4 or 5 billion years, it's been speeding up. That's the weird thing. I mean, the supernovae were fainter than we expected them to be, which meant that they were farther away than expected. And to do that, you need a universe that speeds up in its expansion.
Well, I certainly feel my mind expanding as we talk to Alex.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's great stuff. You know, and everywhere I go, people are really interested in this topic and other, you know, topics of this sort.
And if you've got a question about the cosmos, this is absolutely the person you want to ask. You can give us a call at 941-3689 or from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. We're also listening on Twitter. Roy Gallo is also here from the UH Institute for Astronomy. And Roy, of course, a frequent guest with us because Hawaii does have a pretty significant role in the field of astronomy. Have you had an opportunity or has anyone at the Institute been able to collaborate with Alex on a scientific basis?
Actually, John Tonnery, one of our astronomers, he was in the news last year, at the time of the Nobel Prize, actually, so now a couple of years ago. But many of the telescopes in Mauna Kea were a big part of this Nobel Prize-winning work, took some of the imaging data and some of the spectroscopy that confirmed these supernovae and measured their distances from us. So, he's a good example of someone who actually participated in one of the teams with Brian Schmidt, who is one of the Nobel Prize winners. So, yeah, we do have people. And actually, we have a number of our graduate students, our former undergraduate students of Alex's at Berkeley, and then they came here to do their graduate work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Roy is absolutely correct. John Tonnery was a collaborator on Brian Schmidt's team, of which I was a member. And, in fact, a lot of the data confirming that these really were exploding stars and what type were taken with the Keck telescopes on, of course, the Big Island. And it's not just the supernova whose spectrum we need to get. We need to figure out, you know, the redshift, how much light from that supernova and from the galaxy in which it's located has been stretched during the time that it's been traveling toward us. And it's sort of the brightness, the brightness versus this redshift, that relationship tells us the expansion history of the universe. But Hawaii is like one of the major centers for astronomy in the world, you know, and now we're hoping to build this 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea, and it's just, you know, it's one of the premier sites in the world.
Oh, great. So we want to sort of get your questions in the queue because, you know, we have the esteemed astrophysicist here in the studio to answer any questions that you have about astronomy. We've got a caller, Thomas from Maui, on the line, and we want to welcome you to Bite Marks Cafe.
Aloha. Thanks so much, guys.
Aloha.
Always loved astronomy. Got a lot of computer geek friends who are totally into telescopes and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, really for your average person, I mean, I personally enjoy astronomy, but, you know, learning about stuff that's happened billions of years ago or might happen billions of years from now is interesting. But what I'm curious about is the Lucifer's Hammer, you know, the asteroid that, you know, might take us out or might do some severe damage. Some people say, yes, it's very likely. Other people say, you know, don't worry about it. Other people say, well, if it happens, there's nothing you can do about it anyway.
Right.
You know, recently we had a thing where, you know, there was an asteroid that passed near Earth, and then suddenly there was, you know, something in the sky over Russia, which apparently nobody caught till it was, like, already blasting out windows. So I'd kind of like to get, you know, your guest's opinion on asteroids. Is it really a concern? I mean, I understand there's some people spending some serious money trying to track this stuff.
That's an excellent question. Thanks
and I think,
for
you know,
call.
And I think, Roy, you might have something to say about that. You know, we actually had Ed Liu from the B612 Foundation on the show talking about exactly this issue.
Yeah, and actually the Institute for Astronomy is one of the prime places to talk about, to do this kind of research. So we have the Pan-STARRS telescopes on Maui, which are scanning the skies. And for 5 years from starting about now, are funded by NASA to do just that. Nothing else but that. And another project called ATLAS, which is a smaller telescope, but which will take pictures of the whole sky visible from Hawaii every night. And that will find asteroids and things like the one that exploded over Chelyabinsk. And those small ones can still do damage. And
yes.
The idea is to give us like a few days warning to evacuate areas. So actually, it is a serious threat. Just yesterday or the day before, some people caught a very bright bolide or, you know, a fireball over Ontario, in Toronto, in Canada, on people's dash cams. So these things are coming in very often, and actually recent studies using the devices that are looking for nuclear explosions show that there's many dozens of relatively large explosions just over uninhabited areas. Mm-hmm. So we're a target, and it is a real concern.
But Alex, is it just our awareness because there's more cameras pointed at the sky, more sensors out there? It's not an increasing frequency, is it?
It's not an increasing frequency, but our understanding that this is a significant threat is increasing.
Mm.
Okay, I mean, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the little ones we're trying to do something about, but they're really hard to do something about. On the other hand, they'll maybe destroy a city or something. The big ones that could destroy all of humanity, that could lead to a mass extinction, we can definitely find, say, decades in advance, and then, you know, clever physicists and engineers will send up devices that will slightly deflect these things. That's the idea. We don't want to go the way of the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
Obviously, we'd like to protect cities and stuff, but that's much more difficult, and so, you know, we're not going to stop the rock from hitting us if we only detect it 3 days before it hits.
Right, right.
But we could, as Roy says, evacuate the area.
Well, thanks, Thomas, for that question. And, you know, I think one of the issues that Ed Liu brought up when he talked about the B612 Foundation was that the government and the DOD is not interested in really putting money into finding asteroids and destroying them. That's why the foundation had to start as a nonprofit to really get some funding from the community to actually help fund this effort.
So well, his was a very specific and direct action sort of plan, right, versus right. The observation.
But I would say that since then, actually, since he was a guest here, NASA has made this investment into both Pan-STARRS and the ATLAS program specifically because Congress said, you got to do this.
Good. So we want to also welcome Dan from Kona to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm actually on vacation here from Boston. I brought my telescope all the way.
Oh,
wow.
Good. Hey. Well, I think there's probably some good viewing from Kona.
I've had some great nights of viewing here so far. But my question is actually going back to supernovae.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
I
got
was
the guy here?
Wondering if there's any stars in our galaxy that astronomers are hoping that they'll catch supernovae next. And if you point that out and maybe let us know what it would look like to see a supernovae here on Earth.
Yeah, you know, so obviously, there's a couple hundred billion stars in our galaxy, and some of them will go off, you know, at some point. We just have a hard time predicting which one will go off when. But a good candidate in the next half billion years is Betelgeuse, which is the upper left shoulder of the great hunter Orion, as mm-hmm. seen by us. That's a red supergiant. It's a massive star. We know it's within, you know, half a million years of exploding. We just don't know if it's going to be tonight or in half a million years. Now, probably it's not going to be tonight. The problem is we can't look down into the core of the star and see exactly what stage of its development it's at. Now, at some point, once we develop sufficiently good neutrino detectors, we might detect these little particles on the rise from Betelgeuse, and that'll tell us that, hey, it's about to blow.
Mm.
But right now, we do not have sufficiently accurate detectors, sufficiently sensitive detectors, to be able to look at what's going on in the core of a star and be able to, you know, accurately predict exactly when it's going to go off.
And given the data set you're working with, millions and billions and billions of stars,
yeah.
There could be one observed at any point, but it's hard to be looking at it in advance.
Well, that's right. And, you know, in our own galaxy, interstellar gas and dust, I mean, we call it sort of interstellar smog, the stuff that you can see since you are an astronomer, an amateur astronomer, you know what I'm talking about. You look along Cygnus, for example, or Sagittarius and Scorpius, and you see these blobs, these dark blobs where there seems to be a deficit of stars. It's not that the stars are missing. It's that there are these clouds of gas that have a bunch of dust particles, little bits of stuff associated with them, and the dust tends to block that background light.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been, you know, supernovae in our galaxy in the past few centuries. We've actually found their remnants through studies at X-ray and radio wavelengths. But they went completely undetected at visible wavelengths because, you know, it's like we're looking through a smoggy galaxy. So there have been some, and, you know, we're kind of overdue for a naked eye visible one. I'm hoping that in my lifetime there will be one in our galaxy. We got the next best thing back in 1987. That was very exciting. The Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a satellite of our galaxy, and it can be just barely seen from Hawaii at certain times of the year, just very, very barely. It produced a nice supernova, and we've been studying it, you know, ever since. So that's been fantastic.
So just watch the skies. You know, Thanks for your call.
I'm going to want to ask you a whole bunch of questions about supernova and,
right.
and how
you determine
mm-hmm. which ones are measurable to the extent that you can find, you know, sort of distances between here and there. But I want to hold that thought.
Sure,
we'll be
sure.
right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Alex Filipenko and Roy Gal about the accelerating, expanding universe.
We'll also perhaps ask our astrophysicists about dark energy. But, of course, more importantly, we'd love to hear from you. Call 941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. You are listening to Bite Marks Cafe.
A sizable, well-known store in the heart of Hollywood. Normally, business would be great, but it's a comic book store.
Digital media is killing us. You know, just like record stores, people started downloading music, now they're downloading books and comics. And that's taking effect, but it's not the same as it used to be.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Comic books in the age of tablets. Next time on Marketplace, it's from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
On the next On Being.
The beauty of these stories is that they don't have a single message or moral. It gives us an opportunity to talk about scary things, about cultural contradictions. You know, now we're taming the monsters. We're making friends with them.
Fairy tales, how we use them to understand our fears and our hopes. I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Sunday morning at 10.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa, and we're talking to Roy Gal and Alex Filipenko about the nature of the cosmos.
And what is this sort of implication of the accelerating universe? And of course, I know that's a burning question in your mind. You can give us a call. The number is 941-3689. On Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. And of course, we've got callers on the line, so we want to welcome Richard from Honolulu to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wonder if it's okay to ask a question about quasars.
Sure, it is always okay to ask a question.
No problem. You know, I did my thesis work on miniature quasars in nearby galaxies.
Okay, so then maybe because I haven't heard about them for years. They used to be a big thing because we didn't know what they were.
Well, I mean, you know, we do hear about them every once in a while because I think every once in a while you get these studies that show that, you know, indeed, they're powered by material being sucked in by a supermassive black hole. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about, you know, black holes having masses of 1 to 10, in some cases, billion times the mass of our sun. And that process of stuff being sucked in actually releases energy before the material crosses the actual boundary of the black hole, the so-called event horizon. So there's no contradiction here. It's not that light is coming from within the black hole. Sometimes news agencies get it a little bit wrong there. But it's stuff, you know, falling in, and it just emits energy very, very efficiently. And I think we have, you know, very good evidence for that now. So they're perhaps not quite as much in the limelight as they used to be because now we have all these gamma ray bursts. And a month or two ago, we had this amazing announcement of evidence for inflation in the universe. And then all these exoplanets are being found. So quasars are kind of, you know, they're 50 years old now, and they still are a big thing in astronomy, but they're not the latest, newest big thing.
Exactly. So I have to go back in history a little bit and make my question clear now. So we'll go back to the 1960s, maybe 67, 68, up to 70. And I had a friend that I worked with who was curious about quasars. And he explained, and I can't get a hold of him. I can't catch up with him. I don't know where he is or what he's doing now. But he took a lot of time. I remember he got the first little handheld HP calculator, and he was sitting there punching in numbers and trying to figure something out. And I'll give you the explanation that he had for me. He explained that the differential equations for mass were solvable at the size of the Earth. And then as you take a bigger mass, you couldn't solve the equations. and then they become solvable again at maybe the mass of the sun. And then they, after a while, they wouldn't be solvable again as you added mass to a sun. And his guess was that the equations would be solvable again at the mass of a quasar.
So let me just interject for a moment. Usually differential equations are either solvable or unsolvable, and the mass is just a variable. It doesn't really matter what the numerical value is. You know, it's just there. Now, a certain amount of mass within a certain volume will lead to trapping of light, for example. You know, so that's qualitatively different than having that same amount of mass in a much bigger volume. But the equations should be either solvable or unsolvable. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to look at the calculations in order to be able to comment more deeply.
But I think that it's safe to say that since the 60s, the math has probably gotten a little better.
Yeah, and people have checked these kinds of things. Often, you know, I'll get a question that, you know, someone will say, well, you know, what if this result is not correct? And they'll have some explanation of their own. And the thing is that, you know, there are a lot of astronomers sitting around, and we don't always get things right, but usually we do check the sort of the obvious parts. You know, does this mathematically compute? You know, is it a wrong answer or a right answer? And that kind of a thing is usually done pretty quickly. What's more difficult in observational work is if you have some sort of a weird systematic effect, like you're not taking into account something that might be messing you up. But an equation is either solvable or not, and with today's computers, we can do a lot of things numerically, so we can check up on our pencil and paper computations as well. So that's not as much of an issue anymore.
But thanks, Richard, for that question. Yeah. Quasars are cool, I think.
They really are, yeah. I like them.
Well, we want to also welcome Mark from Hawaii Kai. Welcome to Bite Mark's Cafe.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, I'm an astronomer, actually, so here's some of my questions, because I hope you can educate me and catch me up. How sure are you about the assumption, which I believe is fundamental to the supernova study, that nearby supernova are the same or similar to the much more distant supernova, which formed when the chemical abundances in the universe were actually quite different than what we see nearby?
Yeah, wow. That's actually an excellent question.
Okay,
and,
okay.
You know, so that's something we have to worry about. And what we do is we look at many different observable properties, like the spectrum. You know what that is. You pass the light through a prism, but I'm explaining for the benefit of our other listeners. And you measure the light curve.
Have them say spectroscopist three times.
Yeah, right. There you go. And not spit on your neighbor. Right. So we look at the spectrum. We look at the light curve. We look at many, many properties. And if all of them for the distant supernovae look similar to the nearby ones, then that builds confidence that we're looking at exactly the same phenomenon. Because indeed, you know, what if the nearby light bulbs are 100-watt light bulbs and the distant light bulbs are 90-watt light bulbs and we assume they're 100, then we'll get the wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we look at many different observable properties to see whether they are similar for the distant and the nearby cases. But even then, we're not absolutely sure. And that's why it is so important to have other completely independent techniques. I mentioned that near the beginning of our segment here, that a result has to be verified in science using a number of independent techniques, and that builds overall confidence that you're right. You could be wrong with 17 different techniques that all point to the same result, but you're less likely to be wrong than if only one or two techniques point to the same result. And what we're saying about this acceleration now is that a number of independent techniques with presumably different systematic errors, by the way, your thing was an excellent example of something that I was saying in response to the previous question. It was a possible systematic error that the supernovae of yesterday are different from the supernovae of today. Mm-hmm. But when other techniques give the same answer, you know, they have different systematic errors that might be biting you in the side. But if all those different techniques give the same wrong answer, that's just sort of less likely than all of them giving the same right answer.
Right.
Okay?
I love getting questions from astronomers to stump other astronomers.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you for that call. But when you talked about an equation that you know that there's just something missing, that it's not adding up. I mean, that's my basic understanding of how people started talking about dark matter.
Yeah.
So can you give us a primer on that and how that fits into the expanding universe?
Right. So there are two things. There's dark matter, which helps bind together galaxies and clusters of galaxies. You know, we look at how they're bound. There are clearly lots of them. They're spinning really quickly. They're moving around really quickly within clusters. And we associate some amount of gravity, some amount of gravitational pull with the visible matter. And it turns out that's not enough gravitational pull. So then we dream up this dark matter stuff and we're trying to find other evidence for it. Okay. So that helps bind things together. The dark energy is the conventional explanation for a repulsive effect that is driving apart galaxies that are, you know, isolated and at very big distances from one another, or clusters of galaxies. You know, that's what drives them apart. The galaxies and the clusters themselves are bound. It's the space between them that's being expanded faster and faster because of, you know, this thing that we've dreamed up, dark energy. And that may not be the right explanation, but it's the current sort of best guess as to what's causing this accelerated expansion, dark energy.
So fundamentally, you know, if you think about a vacuum of space, and I know you talked about, you know, sort of this energy density, but if, you know, if you think that there's nothing there, and if you threw this apple with escape velocity, it would continue to go as long and as far as, you know, into infinity.
But right, if you could get it out of our galaxy and out of our cluster of galaxies, then it would keep going away faster and faster, we think.
Well, wouldn't it be a constant velocity as opposed to an acceleration?
It's an acceleration because as its distance from our galaxy increases, there's more and more space within which there's this dark energy. Mm-hmm. So the cumulative effect increases. Right. And the gravitational attraction between the apple and our galaxy decreases with increasing distance. So one effect is decreasing, one effect is increasing, and that actually leads to an acceleration, not just a constant speed.
Okay, so what is it that you are trying to use to measure or determine what exactly is dark energy? I mean, what are some of the tests that might be...
Yeah, so that's a really great question. There are different things that it could be, from just the vacuum of space itself to some sort of a new kind of an energy field. Mm-hmm. Generically, they're called Higgs fields, but it's not the Higgs that was discovered a couple of years ago. It's a different kind of a Higgs, okay? Or sometimes they're called quintessence, okay? This, you know, sort of... Aristotelian fifth essence, in a sense. So all these different candidates for dark energy give different detailed expansion histories of the universe. So, you know, one of them will cause acceleration for a while, then deceleration for a while, then acceleration. Another one will cause acceleration for a longer amount of time or a greater amount. In other words, the different forms of possible dark energy lead to different observable effects on the expansion history of the universe. So by actually measuring the expansion history of the universe, by using great telescopes like those on Mauna Kea, we're trying to set observational constraints on what the dark energy might be.
Mm-hmm.
And we've ruled out certain categories of dark energy, but we've not ruled out a lot of remaining ones. The data right now remain consistent with what is sort of my favorite idea. I mean, it's not my idea, but it's the favorite that I like. And that is that the dark energy really is a property of the vacuum of space itself.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called cosmological constant that Einstein dreamed up in 1917 for the wrong reason. He wanted a static universe, one where this repulsive effect exactly balanced the attractive effect of all the galaxies, giving a static universe. That was, to him, an aesthetically pleasing model.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, at that time, the expansion of the universe had not yet been discovered. Moreover, the sky didn't appear to be falling. So a lot of people felt that a static universe, never with a beginning, no end, was an aesthetically pleasing thing. So he dreamed up this property of space that causes this repulsion that would negate the attractive effects of gravity.
Well, you know, I'm starting to feel like gravity, Sandra Bullock, and running out of oxygen. I'm getting a little dizzy.
Right.
It's
a dizzying subject.
Well, tell me about the presentation you're going to be giving this Saturday, because I liked the description. It was immediately attractive to me. An English major's introduction to the birth and early evolution of the universe. So as a journalism graduate and not an astrophysicist,
right,
what will you do to blow my mind?
Yeah. So I'll be talking about some things that are a little bit related to the current acceleration. And indeed,
that lend credence to some ideas that had been thought of a little over 30 years ago for the birth and early evolution of our universe. And that is that the universe went through an enormously rapid, accelerated phase of expansion when it was about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. I'm not kidding, okay? And, you know, at that time, it was dominated by a repulsive dark energy-like thing. It was called the inflaton. And you might think, wow, this all sounds kind of weird. But in fact, there was some there are some predictions of that model that nicely jibe with the observed universe. And then just 2 months ago, there was a new observation that other astronomers made that seems to pretty directly imply that the universe really did go through this exponential phase of expansion. It's called inflation, and I'll tell you a little bit about that evidence. And then I'll tell you about how these inflation models, in most cases, pretty naturally lead to the idea that our universe may be only one of many.
Oh,
and so
see,
there are all,
yeah,
these, all these big bangs are going off somewhere else, okay? And we live in one of the ones that was conducive to the development of complexity. We live in an interesting universe. A lot of these other universes, there might be a big bang and then a big crunch a short time later, or maybe the big bang is of the kind where the universe expands so quickly that matter doesn't have a chance to clump into galaxies and stars, and so that wouldn't be very good for us either, okay? So we may live in one of the good ones. It's kind of an interesting idea, this multiverse.
So that's just a theory. I mean, has there been any kind of evidence toward a multiverse?
Well, no, not directly. And this is where we're at sort of the boundary of what can be called science. But it's not that we just dream this stuff up at 3 a.m. when we get up to go to the bathroom. I mean, there are good physical reasons for thinking that inflation may have occurred and for thinking that it may have occurred many, many times. And that's based on solid physics. But the conclusion that there's a multiverse, by its very nature, at least temporarily removes itself from the realm of science because it's not immediately testable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, long ago, we thought all kinds of things weren't testable, and they're now being tested. So what is not flatly, squarely in the realm of science right now may someday become part of the realm of science. And insofar as this new result I'll mention 2 months ago supports inflation, it indirectly supports the multiverse idea because most theories of inflation say that it should have occurred many, many times, okay?
Right.
You can answer this question
with
just one answer or one word.
Oh,
should I just throw out the idea of conservation of energy?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. You guys are good. Okay, Bert, I mean, no. So it turns out that an
inflating, you can say yes or no.
Yeah, no, it does not throw out the conservation of energy.
Oh, okay.
It turns out, and I won't go into this in great depth because I know we're running out of time, but it turns out that an inflating universe conserves energy. You can think of the energy of our universe being zero.
Mm.
There's obviously us, which is a positive energy, but our gravitational attraction for everything else in the universe can be thought of as a negative energy.
Mm.
And you can think of this anytime you drop an apple or a bottle of water. It starts from rest. It picks up speed. Where is that speed coming from, that kinetic energy? It's coming from an equal negative gravitational energy.
Hmm.
So this process of dropping an apple or a bottle of water conserves energy. It's zero all the way, okay, mm-hmm. if you define it to be zero from the beginning. In a similar way, you can define the energy of our universe to be zero, and at all times in an inflating universe, it remains zero.
All right.
You know, so it's weird. I mean,
Bert,
yeah,
you don't
yeah,
have to
okay,
throw
okay.
that out.
Yeah.
Roy, there's clearly a lot to cover. Tell us very quickly how someone can hear more of Alex this Saturday.
Okay, you got to be quick. Go to uhifa.ticketbud.com and click on the event title, and I'll take you a page to get tickets. We are almost sold out. Before I
Kennedy
came in,
Theater.
It's free.
It's at the Kennedy Theater. It's
but
totally free, but we got a ticket. There's 600 seats. We've got 550 gone.
Okay,
wow.
You got to sign up now.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, and show up if you're on the wait list because sometimes there are no shows.
Right.
And let me just mention that, you know, that same day, May 10th, is Astronomy Day. It's National
right.
Astronomy Day, and so that's a great way to get kids and the general public interested in science and astronomy. And I'll actually be doing a Reddit, an Ask Me Anything, from 9 a.m. to about 12:15. Yeah, an AMA. 9 to 12:15 Hawaii time, so you can send me a question then, and then also at a brand new website that my wife Noelle made, astroalex.org. there's an Ask Alex section where we will archive the answers
we'll
that
get
I
all
give.
Those Astro up on the, Alex. That's right. We'll get those all on the show notes.
Very good.
Alex Filipenko is the professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley, and Roy Gal is an assistant astronomy professor over at the University of Hawaii.
And thank you for joining us, gentlemen.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Great
thank
questions.
You for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And of course, next week you can tune in and hear about Makani Pahili. And we want to thank you for listening. And of course, stay tuned for another edition of Bite Marks Cafe coming up next Wednesday.